You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents...
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
Invasive species have been a staple of horror for a long time. In a sense, a vampire often comes into communities like an invasive species, slowly expanding its influence and growing its legions of followers, sometimes exponentially. The 1962 film Day of the Triffids is loosely based on the novel by John Wyndham and follows what happens in England when the country is invaded by carnivorous plants. But these scenarios of new species coming into our ecosystems and wreaking havoc are not all science fiction. Unfortunately, they're often horror. Perhaps no country in the world better exemplifies this than Australia, where a variety of unfortunately misguided schemes to use imported animals to various purposes have left the native fauna and flora overwhelmed by unchecked populations of foxes, rabbits, and the subject of today's episode, enormous poisonous toads.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Stephen Johnson of the University of Florida about the invasive species known as the cane toad. They're a frighteningly resilient species of toad that breeds aggressively and excretes toxic fluid from zit-like glands on their back. You can check the show notes for pictures. While they're definitely more harmful than a mere nuisance, I can't help but be impressed with their astonishing biological arsenal. Well, I say that now, but Australia isn't the only country they've invaded, and it may not be long until they join the fire ant, the armadillo, and the coyote, as species that have all shown up unexpectedly in my home state during my lifetime. Special thanks to Karen Stolzno for putting this interview together. We hope you enjoy it.
Monster Talk.
All right, welcome to Monster Talk, Stephen Johnson. Stephen is an associate professor in the Department of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at the University of Florida. Now, that's in Florida, right?
That would be Florida. That would be Gainesville, Florida, North Central Florida.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've been through Gainesville many times, and a friend of the show, Stacey Sharp, hails from there.
Nice.
That's sort of like in the northern central part, not too far from the state line.
North of Orlando, about a two-hour drive if you drive 80 miles an hour.
Stephen, I watched a documentary on cane toads a couple of years ago, and having grown up in Australia, I'm very familiar with cane toads and the problem that they've become in some parts of the country. So for quite some time, we've been wanting to do an episode on cane toads. And when I Googled cane toads, you came up. So your lab at the University of Florida. So maybe if you could begin by telling us a little bit about the Johnson Laboratory at the University of Florida.
Yeah, so I'm a native Floridian. I've been in Florida pretty much all my life, with a few exceptions, at forays, as a matter of fact, sabbatical in Australia a number of years ago. But
nice.
So my students and I do a lot of teaching and outreach, and research is conducted through collaborators and my students. And students frequently study non-native and invasive species, and these range from anything from rhesus macaque monkeys to Cuban tree frogs, which are native to the Caribbean and are introduced and invasive in Florida, as well as the cane toad, which is not native to Florida, not native to Australia, and it's invasive in both places. And I actually had a postdoc from Australia who was here up until a couple months ago, and we found a lot of new information on cane toads in Florida that is different from what has been found in Australia in some regards, and also similar. So just have a lot of interest in non-native species and teaching people about them. And so cane toads are kind of near and dear to my heart. They're little monsters I'm very fond of, but it's a love-hate relationship.
I'm sure.
Well, a sabbatical in Australia, is that like an out sabbatical?
That is it, yeah.
It's terrible.
I took 9 months off, and I went to Australia to learn about their incredible fauna. They don't have any native toads in Australia, which is probably why the cane toads cause so many issues.
Ooh, that's weird, though. Mm. Why, do they have any native amphibians at all?
Yeah, they've got some native frogs. So there's three major groups of amphibians. There are the frogs, or the anurans. There are the salamanders, or the uridials, as they're sometimes called. And then Sicilians.
Never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line!
Which are this sort of worm-like, elongate, slender, snake-looking type of amphibian. And Australia only has frogs, whereas here in Florida, North America, we have frogs and salamanders. And then if you go to the tropics, like let's say go down to Brazil, you'd have Sicilians and frogs and salamanders. But even though they have frogs, there's no native toads in the family that the cane toad is in Australia. And that's probably why they've been such an issue there. And they have been a major for the Aussies, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm sure we'll get a lot into that tonight. But how did you get an interest in cane toads to begin with?
Well, my interest, I love turtles as a kid. I love biology. And, going up, went to undergraduate, graduate school, PhD, working with sea turtles initially, then a salamander. And I was working here in Florida for the U.S. Geological Survey as a research wildlife biologist. And I was working on the Amphibian Research and Monitoring Initiative, ARMI, which is a federal program to study and monitor amphibian populations throughout the U.S., mainly on public land. And I was getting emails from friends and colleagues at the University of Florida, where I got my PhD, about Cuban tree frogs. And sort of that piqued my interest. And so I sort of delved into it there. And that was my entrance into working with non-native and invasive species. And the Cuban tree frog is a monster in Florida, a little monster in its own right. And that just sort of led to other things. And eventually, cane toads came on my radar. And I became really interested because I was getting emails and calls from people who were having problems with cane toads. And I thought, well, this is something I need to address from a research and a teaching and outreach perspective.
Great. You're perfect for this episode.
I know we've talked a lot about biology on over the decade we've done this show. And one of the things that I find really interesting is that the distinctions that humans try to do to put animals into groups. So we talk a lot about the phylogenetics and how, taxonomy and those sort of classifications. But toads and frogs, like I grew up learning the basic distinction, but I'm not so sure there is the distinction that I think there is. Can you talk about the current thinking around the difference between a toad and a frog?
All right. Well, this comes up a lot, and you're right. We as humans and as biologists, I think we like to compartmentalize things and organize them in a framework that we can understand. And people often say, they talk about toads and frogs or salamanders and newts is another example. But the bottom line is a toad is just a specific type of frog. All toads are frogs, but not all frogs are toads. Just like a newt is a specific type of salamander. All newts are salamanders, but not all salamanders are newts. So toads in general, at least the ones that we have in Florida and North America, tend to be stout-bodied, terrestrial. They have a little drier skin than other frogs, even though they will dry out and desiccate if they're in really dry conditions. And they're warty, and like cane toad has these big paratoid glands. So all amphibians have very glandular skin. But the bottom line is, when you talk about a toad, it's just a particular type of frog.
We'll probably ask a lot of questions like that.
Axolotl?
Yes.
We should have warned you about the puns.
Being a science nerd, I like that. That's a great. I've got a frog joke for you later if you'll indulge me. So
yes, absolutely. You're entitled to whatever you need to do. So,
so could we start with some of the basics about cane toads? Maybe some information about their biology and where they're from.
Sure. So they're native to Central and South America, down into Brazil. They actually do get into the United States in very extreme southern Texas. They need to be near water, like many frogs. They lay eggs in, like many toads, they lay eggs in long strings, and they have a free-living aquatic tadpole stage. And the male calls to attract the females, like in many frogs. Although there are some, there's some frogs I mentioned that have a tadpole. There are some frogs that lay their eggs terrestrially, and there's no tadpole stage. But like the sort of standard frog that most people think about, they have tadpoles that have to develop in water. Interestingly enough, unlike many frogs, the cane toad, the life history, the eggs, the tadpoles, the juveniles, and the adults are all toxic. The adults are the most toxic. They tend to be more terrestrial. They'll burrow down with their rear feet. They're a generalist predator, feeding on all kinds of invertebrates. Although a big cane toad could easily take a small vertebrate, like a small mouse or a small snake. They're, like all frogs, they have beautiful eyes. If you've never gazed into the eyes of a frog before, I would encourage you to do that.
Look into my eyes. Look.
So even toads have a redeeming feature. They do have beautiful eyes, like most other frogs. But, and they have their native range. Like I said, a very broad native range that they cause no problems, but they've been introduced and become invasive many places. They're spurred to breed when it's, at least in Florida and Australia too, when it's warmer and it's wet out, because as amphibians they have permeable skin and they'll lose moisture if it's too dry out. And so that's a little bit about their biology.
Great.
Well, now my understanding is that they're also toxic.
Yep, they have. So toads in the family Bufonidae, and that's the family the cane toad is in, going back to the phylogenetics, or how we compartmentalize organisms to understand hopefully how they're related. That's why we put them in groups. And so any toad or any frog that's in the same family, we would presume evolutionary speaking is more closely related than one that is in a different family, and one's in the same scientific genus. So every organism on the planet follows the classification that was developed well over 100, maybe 200 years ago by the scientist Linnaeus. And so they all have a genus and a species. And so the genus, that first part of that name, if they're in the same genus, they're more closely related, we hope, evolutionarily speaking. So they're in the family Bufonidae, and they have these large, particularly cane toads, have these really large glands on their shoulders called parotoid glands. And it's this large gland that's an accumulation of a bunch of poison ducts. And if that gland is put under pressure, it will literally squirt out like literally you're popping a zit. You squeeze that gland under pressure, and this very viscous, thick bufotoxin will actually squirt out. And that is the poison. That's the poison that the toad yields. That's this little monster's its weapon. And the issue is if an animal like a dog here in Florida or Australia, many of the native mammals, if they bite a toad and it squirts that thick viscous toxin out, that can spell trouble for the animal that's bitten and possibly sometimes cause death.
Mm-hmm. Even to humans in some cases.
Humans, I know, and I don't know the details, sir, but from what I've seen, you mentioned there's two of these cane toad documentaries, and I've seen one, and it's pretty campy and sort of cultish, but the information by and large is correct, and I've heard that it can cause temporary blindness and actually cause hallucinations. And I believe in Queensland, Australia, the state of Queensland, cane toad toxin is considered a controlled substance even, or it was at one time.
I was wondering about that. I know some people do. There are toads that people lick for hallucinogenic effect. But also I was curious about, is it toxic through your skin or does it have to be ingested? Obviously, if it gets in your eyes, that sounds like a bad trip.
So it's a poison rather than a venom. So like a venomous snake bites you and it injects a venom. A bee stings you and injects a venom. The toads are not venomous, they're poisonous. By that, also, they're toxic. So if you want to avoid your pet, your dog, encountering a cane toad, whether you're in Australia or Florida or wherever they are, that can be a bad thing. But yeah, so they're poisonous or they're toxic to a pet that ingests it, And the toad, that gland, that parotoid gland, has to be under pressure to squirt it out. Although a stressed toad can sort of ooze that, but unless that gland is under pressure, they can't squirt it. So, you don't have to worry about a cane toad hopping up to you and sort of, rearing up on its rear legs and squirting you in the eye with its poison. It can't do that, but it will ooze out. And it's mainly, again, if it's under pressure. And it can squirt, several feet. I made the mistake of squeezing or expressing a cane toad gland at a talk one time I was giving on in Florida. And the people in the front row, I was like, whoa, that went a lot further than I thought. I'm so sorry. Needless to say, I did not do that again. So we have a native toad here in Florida called a southern toad that also has these glands. And after handling a bunch of them one night and knowing they were getting their parotoid gland toxin on me, I tasted it just out of curiosity. It was quite bitter. I didn't see, rainbow effects. I didn't trip anything off of it. But I was just, scientific curiosity. So I gave it a taste. It was bitter. And I assume a predator would taste that bitterness as well.
Good on you for trying. I hear in Australia that crows know that the cane toads have this poison on their backs. And so they flip them over and eat their bellies instead.
Crows are mad. Same thing here. Mm-hmm. There are certain animals that know how to deal with them, but flip them over, go through the underbelly, and you can avoid those big toxic glands for sure.
Yep. So you've already mentioned that cane toads have come to be invasive species in Florida and in Australia. I guess we should talk about a few of these examples. I think the case in Australia is particularly interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, first let me back up, and so we use the term invasive species, and I always like to define that because different people have different concepts in their mind what it is. So loosely the definition I follow is an invasive species is a species of animal, and it's geographically, you got to put it into context. because in their native range, cane toads are not invasive. They're native there. But in their introduced range, where they have been moved to by people, either accidentally or on purpose, and in Florida, both cases was on purpose. Florida and Australia, particularly in Australia, they were introduced there on purpose with the concept that they would control the sugarcane grubs, which they did not do. So people introduced this cane toad, this toad, to Australia. It's not native to Australia. It was brought there by people. And then an invasive species is one that's introduced outside of its native range, either intentionally or unintentionally by people, where it does or certainly has the potential to cause negative environmental impacts, have negative impacts on the economy where it's been introduced, or have negative impacts on human welfare and human quality of life. Mm-hmm. And certainly in Australia, it has had major environmental impacts. Cause local declines of species such as quolls, which is this really fabulous small cat-like marsupial, as well as declines of crocodiles, freshwater crocodiles, as well as some of Australia's frog-eating snakes. It's had negative economic impacts on Australia as well, because there's been a lot of money spent on studying the cane toads, doing research to try to figure out how they can be trapped and removed, and also doing research to understand about them. And no doubt it's had negative impacts on human quality of life. When Aussies have a dog that attacks one, a pet dog that either has to, you know, incur a cost to go to the veterinarian or your dog dies, that's a major negative impact on you. In Florida, it's more of a socioeconomic thing. My view now, and you know, that might change as time passes, but they don't really invade bushlands or natural areas so much in Florida as they do in Australia. But in Australia, so they were brought in the 30s to control cane grubs, brought from Australia, released at several sites in Queensland, and have since just spread all over the place. And they've been really, really interesting study species for a guy named Dr. Rick Schein. He and his students have published probably hundreds of papers on cane toads, and they've looked at evolution, impacts, all kinds of really interesting studies that have come about. So that's a little bit of a silver lining. They've sort of been an unintended, you know, monster natural experiment in Australia.
And what's the population like? Do you have any idea? Because I think originally they just released a few of them, didn't they? And then they thought they had some success initially, and then they released 50,000 or 60,000. And nowadays I've no idea how many are there.
Yeah, I think what it was is there were animals that were brought over by, you know, back in the 30s, you know, we weren't as global an economy as we are now, brought over by ship from Hawaii and then released at several places in Queensland. One, there's a site south of Cairns, which is people will pronounce it Cairns because that's how the folks from the U.S. at least, because that's not.
We say Cairns.
Yeah, it's Cairns. It was in Gordonvale. And there's actually a small park there I've been to a number of times with my students on study abroad. And there's a mural talking about the story of the cane toad. But so they were introduced there in several other places. And those original toads, just they're very prolific. So a large female might lay 30,000 eggs at one time. And, you know, if a good portion of those tadpoles survive, that's a huge bump in the population. And then they breed, you know, and so on, and they just expand. And the cane toads in Australia, and Australia is about the size of the continental U.S. And so if you know the U.S., you know, if you think about it, okay, they would have been introduced around North Carolina, north of North Carolina. That's roughly if you superimpose Australia over the United States. But they would have spread literally as far across as the Dakotas, if you were thinking about Australia as the U.S., and almost as far south as Georgia in the U.S. In Australia, that's way over across the top end and the Northern Territory into Western Australia, and then heading far south of Brisbane, you know, down towards Sydney. And there's an invasion front where the toads move very rapidly, and they hop farther, they hop faster, they have a body style that's more adapted through evolution to dispersing than the animals in the more established areas. So it's been a really, really interesting yet sad situation in Australia from a scientific standpoint. Extremely, extremely interesting and and the subject of a lot of research, but also, you know, the major impacts on that unique Australian fauna that has just been plagued by feral and invasive species, be they foxes or cats and then cane toads. So there's such a problem there. I'm glad they're not as big of an issue here in Florida right now, but they're still a concern. They're still a concern for us, no doubt.
Statistically, to get those numbers, do they have to do a lot of tadpoling?
there's been a lot of work tadpoling.
Yeah.
And the numbers of animals, I don't think anyone can answer that question. How many are there in Australia? You know, millions, if not billions. And here in Florida, probably millions. You just, it's so difficult. People say, well, how many are there? It's so difficult to answer that question.
Sure.
Sorry.
It's a statistical challenge. I know.
Yeah. Census. How many people are there in the U.S.? Well,
I need a cane toad census.
You have to use all your senses to get the answers. Exactly. So
you can't go knocking on people's doors and say, how many cane toads do you have living in your yard?
Exactly. Legally? Legally?
There's heaps of them, as they would say in Australia.
But you know, Florida's got a lot
that makes sense.
I mean, Florida also is having some big problems with the Burmese pythons, right? I mean, you've got all kinds of interesting problems. It's interesting. It's parallel, I guess, in a lot of ways, right, to what's going on in Australia.
Florida is the global epicenter of introductions of herpetofauna, and by that I just mean amphibians and reptiles, mainly reptiles. The cane toad is one of only about half a dozen of established and breeding species of frogs, but we have got about three times as many introduced, non-native, established inbreeding species of lizards in Florida as we do native species of lizards in Florida. We've got Burmese pythons. We've got tegu lizards, you know, and we've got, you know, lionfish off our coast.
Yeah, iguanas in the Keys. Yeah, yeah.
All these kinds of things. And a lot of it, you know, with the cane toads, the invasion pathway was intentional introduction for biological control. But more recently, it's the pet industry, the pet trade. Importing animals for the pet trade is something that Florida and the U.S. really needs to crack down on. The Australians do a great job of that. They don't allow you to bring things in, but they've learned from their mistakes of the past. We haven't.
You'd mentioned that cane toads are dangerous to crocodiles and snakes in Australia, and I'm just wondering, how does that work? How's that possible? I thought that it'd be the other way around.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, so Australia is such an awesome place. So Australia was part of, you know, when, you know, back in the day, you know, millions of years ago, as best we can tell, all of the terrestrial continents were together in a big supercontinent called Pangaea. So right now we need to reunite Pangaea. We need to bring everyone from the world together and realize, hey, we're on one planet, we're one people, we have to solve our problems together. But I digress. So Pangaea broke up and there was some northern continents and there was the southern continents. And the southern continents were part of this big land mass called Gondwana. And Australia broke off from Gondwana, from South America and even Antarctica, and it drifted alone in splendid isolation for millions of years. And as it did, so when it broke off, it took a subsample of the Gondwana fauna with it. And then you had a lot of unique evolutionary history of mammals there. That's why you had, you know, the marsupials become so diverse. And you have the monotremes that are there in Gondwana in Australia, New Zealand, and nowhere else. North of there in Papua New Guinea. And so you have this fauna in Australia that did not evolve with a toxic prey item like the cane toad. And therefore you would think, oh, you know, how could a cane toad kill a snake, you know, a large snake or a crocodile? It's because those native animals in Australia have not come to recognize the cane toad is toxic, and they don't have a physiology to be able to deal with that toxin. Whereas I think one of the reasons in Florida why it hasn't been an issue, or possibly, is that a lot of our native mammals and our native reptiles have evolved with a more closely related native species, and they either know to avoid them or they've evolved the, you know, the physiological mechanisms to deal with their toxins. So that's, you know, that's my best guess as to why they could kill a crocodile.
That's really interesting. So we've talked about how corvids
can learn to flip the toads to avoid the...
And crows and jays, they are smart birds.
Yeah.
They're really...
But other animals, if I understand what you're saying, they have a couple of vectors towards dealing with this. One would be to develop toxicity resistance, right? And that would be a slow change over time. Clearly, some natural selection at play.
Right.
But the other one would be to figure out as a species how to recognize, and I like how to recognize the toads as toxic and avoid them. And that seems like that would also be something like if the animals don't have the mental facility to communicate to each other like some of these birds do, how, you know, is that something that is also naturally selected for, a preference against it? Yeah,
I think it is. And I recall reading some research in Australia, and then the Aussies are, you know, they're incredibly resourceful and creative people, and I'm pretty sure I've seen in the literature where there's been some sort of aversion training to try to teach some Australian, you know, animals, I think in a captive situation, but maybe even extending this, and you guys could probably, you know, do some Google searching of the literature to see this, but actually doing this maybe with wild animals. And there has been some, I think, evidence to show that populations of Australian animals that have encountered cane toads, you know, you'll have the number of more aggressive ones, and, you know, for the selection to occur, you got to have a lot of individual variation. Ones that, you know, attack, you know, just full on might die, but then ones that are a little more sheepish, you know, they might have a bad experience but not die and then learn to avoid them. And so that kind of evolution, I believe, is occurring. And I believe the Australians are actually using that to their advantage to try to, you know, sort of train, if you will, some of their native fauna to avoid the toads.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I had no idea about that, but I grew up in Sydney and I never saw one the whole time that I was there. But my mother lives in Queensland on the Sunshine Coast. Mm. And I mean, you see them everywhere. Often you see desiccated ones around. Occasionally you'll see a live one, and they are much bigger than they are physically. They're, I don't know if you've, I'm sure you've encountered them in the wild, but they are really aggressive and they like to bloat themselves up and to challenge you. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're mean bastards.
Yeah, they are no doubt. They're little monsters, you know, and they'll,
yeah.
So, you know, if you pick one up, it will swell up.
Oh,
with
God, no. And no.
That's a standard, you know, frog or toad thing, to make yourself be larger to a predator. But I've seen lots of them in Australia when I've been traveling around, you know, under lights or in caravan or RV parks, you know, or just hopping around in the yards, you know, where folks that I've friends that I've stayed with. I've seen them there. I've seen them in Hawaii as well. It was the first amphibian, native amphibians in Hawaii. But first thing I saw in Hawaii from an amphibian standpoint was a cane toad. And unfortunately, we don't have them up here in Gainesville, Florida yet, but they're from about Orlando, central Florida, you know, south. And people are learning more and more about them because here in Florida, they seem to really do the best in human-modified environments, whereas in Australia, they'll do good in you know, suburban areas as well in the bush. You know, they need water sources. So there's research that would suggest that, you know, because Australia is a very arid country, so the troughs or the tanks are basically the holes in the ground that the Aussies dig for water for the cattle has facilitated the movement of cane toads in Australia. So there it's the same as, you know, humans have modified the environment a lot to the, you know, and these, you know, these invasive monsters, you know, take advantage of that, many mm-hmm. of them.
Yeah, I remember one day just reversing the car at my mother's place, and one saw us and just challenged the car, just blew itself up, and was ready to fight.
Yeah, there's a great these two great documentaries, you know, Cane Toads, An Unnatural History, and there's a little girl that lives in the Tablelands outside of Cairns, and she has this massive toad she calls Dairy Queen. The toad is—it's just huge. I mean, she's a little girl in the video. This is a massive toad the size of a dinner plate, and a toad that
those
these really big poison glands. You know, and if a dog attacks that, you know, and bites that gland, it's, you know, forget it for the dog. And then there's this second documentary, you know, I think it's called Cane Toads: The Conquest. It's a lot of the same characters are in there. It's really, really interesting to see. They're great. They're great documentaries. I show those to students in my invasion ecology class, and they're entertaining, but they've got a lot of facts built in there, and you can learn a lot about cane toads and their biological and their socioeconomic impacts in Australia. It's really they're really great. That's like almost, you know, that you got to put a link to those if people can get those. It's really great in the era of COVID when we're all stuck at home. Screw Netflix. Let's watch some cane toads.
Well, I know when you see something smaller than you behave in a way where it's not afraid, it can be very disconcerting even to a human. These guys, these cane toads, they bow up when they're in defensive mode. So is that, I mean, this is not really a joke. Is that leading to a lot of people mowing them with their lawnmowers, that kind of thing?
I don't know about that, but they will, you know, if they feel threatened, they'll suck in air and they'll sort of stand up and they can lean towards you. They're just trying to look more intimidating, you know, just like a lot of snakes in the U.S. will puff up, they'll flare out their jaws, they make themselves look more intimidating. It's just, that's their mechanism to try to protect themselves, you know?
Sure.
And, you know, and some people will be, you know, put off by that. You know, those of us who are out looking for them, I'm like, oh, good, you're not going to run or try to crawl away from me. You're easy to pick up, or you're make yourself a better, you know, a subject for a photo. But it's just, you know, it's just their mechanism to try to protect themselves.
Sure.
Is what's on.
Well, I know here, like, we've got I don't know if they're really invasive because they've been in the United States, but the you probably have them there too. In fact, I know you do. We've got armadillos now. That was not a thing when I was a kid. I mean, they existed,
from
but
Texas.
They weren't in my state. And now they've made it into Georgia, so I know we saw them all over Orlando when we were at Disney a few years ago. And unlike the opossum, which has the bad habit of its defense is to pass out. Not good if you're on the road. The armadillo's defense is apparently to hop up, which I guess would be great if it didn't put it right in the grill of the car.
I've experienced that. Tried to straddle a possum with a Jeep I had one time, and it was scared and it jumped and hit the underside of my Jeep. And when I was coming home from work, there it lay, belly up on the road. So, yeah, sometimes, you know, animals are maladapted, just like the Burmese pythons. Mm-hmm. When it gets, you know, on the rare instance that we get a really cold snap in Florida, the pythons are coming out. They will come out into the sun to try to bask to warm up. But then it gets too cold for them and they can succumb. If they would just hang out underground, they would avoid that. So they're sort of maladapted to deal with that cold. So, but it worked good where they were native. Doesn't work so good here, but, you know, it hasn't done anything to curtail their populations. They're proliferating in the Everglades and in South Florida, and they've had major impacts. They're a really, really bad invasive species in Florida, without a doubt.
So I know that there seem to be a lot of urban legends about cane toads. I know in the sort of Brisbane, Sunshine Coast, Gold Coast areas that people think that you can freeze them to kill them, and that they're pouring salt on their backs. Lots of different ways to get rid of them. Are you aware of any of these urban legends and what actually does work to eradicate them?
I am not, but I'm not surprised to hear them. So I do advocate, you know, I've got a series of outreach, you know, documents, some little videos I've done, and I educate people here in Florida, and I would do the same in Australia, you know, that you You know, it's not that, you know, it's not the toad's fault or the Cuban tree frog's fault or the python's fault, so to speak, that they're here. But they shouldn't be here. And to protect our economies and our native environments and to be an advocate for our native species, I encourage people to capture and humanely euthanize Cuban tree frogs and cane toads. And with cane toads, there is research done out of Australia, again, by this professor, Rick Schein. He teamed up with some neurologists, and they showed that, you know, from the data that they had, the paper that I read, if you would take a cane toad and you would hand capture it, you could just use a plastic sack that you would get at a grocery store, capture the toad by hand, and if you have them in your yard, you can go out at night and shine a torch if you're in Australia, which is basically U.S. American for flashlight.
For lights, yeah.
You know, just decisively grab the toad, turn the bag inside out, tie it shut, and if you're willing to, you know, put it in your refrigerator for a couple hours. That physically is an anesthetic. It slows down the toad's metabolism, and you can put it in the freezer for 24 hours and will kill it humanely. Or if you cast, you can apply a chemical anesthetic, such as ointment you might spray on your topically on your skin, or for rash, poison ivy, or sunburn, or even apply a gel that you would use, you know, to deal with toothaches. And that would then anesthetize the toad, and then you put it in the freezer for 24 hours, and it will kill it humanely. Now, a lot of people
Are you suggesting we Novocaine toad?
Yes, Novocaine toad, and then freeze it. And you know what? It's not going to taint your vanilla ice cream if the toad is fresh. It's not going to, you know, it's no threat to you or your food. You can still eat your frozen pork chops and your pizza. But, you know, that's what I tell folks to do.
I can't believe that that's true. Heard that growing up, and I thought that was a urban legend of some kind. So that's amazing.
But we're speaking here specifically about humanely killing the toad.
Yeah.
So anything that is rapid and is a sort of peaceful or painless death would be considered humane. But I advocate, you know, either the chemical or the anesthetic followed by freezing. That's what I tell people to do, because that follows, you know, veterinary guidelines. There's actually a product in Australia called Hopstop that's an anesthetic spray that has been marketed. I think they had some issues with the cans sort of exploding, but I believe it's still for sale. And you can spray the toads with that. But then in the U.S., you don't want to put Raid or bleach on them. You don't want the animal to suffer.
Right.
You want it to die a humane death if you're going to kill it.
The bleach would ruin the flavor. There's so many things to consider. It's like,
I guess people eat frogs. Do people eat toads?
I don't know. If you were, you know what? I'd be darn sure to take the skin off.
Oh yeah, gross. Yeah,
That's where the poison glands are.
Right.
I've never tried it. I've tried Nile monitor lizard. That's an invasive species in Florida that one of my colleagues caught and cooked, and it was, you know, I'm going to stick with with chicken.
That's if we started talking about weird things we've eaten, we'd be here all night, because I have eaten a lot of weird things.
Yeah, that's for another show.
That's
I guess.
Another show. So I'm very interested. This is such a weird, I mean, this must be strange. I apologize, but this sort of hop between these ridiculous jokes and then like serious biological questions.
Hop between.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know. It's what we do.
I heard you. I caught you.
Yeah, okay. See, I do actually, I have to, this is an aside to Karen. I actually do understand subtlety, but people don't think that I do. The problem is when I'm subtle, nobody laughs or rolls their eyes or goes, ah.
Speaking of that, remember, I've got a frog joke for you, you know.
Anytime you want to tell it.
Are you ready? Are you asking?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, go. If you want to do it here, that's perfect. Let's go for it.
So, what type of soda do frogs drink?
No idea.
Of course, Coca-Cola. Oh, thank you for laughing.
That's cute.
I stunned my wife yesterday. My wife's name's Kathleen. I stunned Kathleen yesterday. I walked into the kitchen and said, I've just come for this great invention, a mechanical uterus. It's a labor-saving device.
And And she repeated that on Facebook and
Yeah,
Twitter
she did later.
And...
But her immediate response was, she was in front of the sink, and I really thought she was going to throw up.
I think she was the first thing to throw at you, Blake.
So, yeah, it is dangerous to do that in the kitchen where all the knives and stuff are. So... This would be kind of a follow-up, which would be, do we know what predators they do have in their native world? I mean, we've talked about, obviously, the birds aren't doing enough in Australia to keep up with it. But, what animals do successfully eat these without too much harm?
Yeah, there would be birds who could deal with them, some mammals. Again, it wasn't a natural setting. It's sort of contrived, but... When I had a postdoc here in Florida within the past year named Dr. Benjamin Muller, and we tested this trap that's produced by a company called ACTA, that's Australian, and it's a cage trap, a metal trap with a steel roof and bottom, and it has a little call lure in there, a little speaker that plays a cane toad call. It also has a little LED light, and it's attached to via a long wire to a solar panel that charges it. And when the panel stops sending a charge to the mechanism in the trap, it signals, hey, okay, it's gotten dark, which is the time cane toads are becoming active. And the lure starts playing the cane toad call with the idea that it attracts females. And very rarely, never in Australia, did they catch any non-target organisms, only caught toads. And we hardly ever caught any non-target organisms in Australia. But one time we did catch an American opossum or a Virginia opossum, Didelphus virginianus. And that thing ate that toad. It didn't go in through the belly. It didn't go around. It just seemed to consume the whole darn toad without any apparent toxic effects.
Huh.
So it didn't need to go around the toxins. And I'm working on a little small note, a manuscript right now that is sort of summarizing some observations of Florida's snakes encountering the toads. And I've seen a photograph of one of our native water snakes that was dead and it had rotted. And clearly there was a cane toad within its stomach. But I've seen other instances where snakes had just consumed them whole. So... I don't know. Again, evolutionary history, maybe they have it that, they're able to deal with it. But so some mammals we know might be able to consume them whole. Other ones could, flip them over and go through the belly and eat the internal organs and avoid those toxic glands. So, a hungry animal is generally tends to be, pretty persistent and smart. But, in Florida, we just don't know enough about that. About the impacts on native wildlife. It doesn't appear to be much, and it's either one, it's because the cane toads don't invade the natural areas so much like they do in Australia. That's possibly part of it, and it might also be that our species are just able to deal with the cane toad, because like we talked about earlier, they evolved with them. In Australia, they haven't. But generally, a larger predator probably just going to attack the whole toad. But it was a really interesting observation that we made of that opossum just consuming the entire toad without any ill effects, which was kind of surprising.
Amazing, yeah. And so we were talking about the introduction of cane toads to Australia, but could we – so I'm going back a little bit further into the interview that we've done so far, but I'm just wondering, why is it that the cane toads – failed to control the grubs? What went wrong?
Well, I think it was an ill-fated experiment or ill-fated effort to begin with. So this whole concept of biological control is using one, animal or organism to control the population of another. And it's been used for invasive species for a while. And so, for instance, introducing mongoose, which is, like a ferret, a small carnivore, to control whatever it might be, snakes or something. We've learned that vertebrate animals, mongoose, cane toads, whatever, they're really bad biological controls because they are not specialists. So while you might have had some cane toads that in some places might have eaten some cane grubs In fact, they don't, they just weren't at the right place together at the right time. And they ate so much more. They weren't specific to that. So for a biological control to really work, you want it to avoid non-target organisms. So you would want to, let's say, bring in some species of beetle that only eats one species or a small group of plants that are not native in an area. And you don't want it to eat closely related species that are native. And it turns out that cane toads are just very generalist predators. So while they might have eaten some cane beetles, they did not eat enough of them, and they didn't focus specifically on those cane beetles to be effective. And it took a while for us to, you know, for people to realize that. And these days, you know, you just don't introduce a vertebrate or more of a generalist predator to control anything. It's that there's been enough ill-fated experiments for us to finally realize that's the wrong strategy to take.
Learned from our mistakes.
What year was the cane toad introduced? Do we know?
Through a lot of places around the world, it was in the 1930s. That was sort of the heyday.
Yes, it was in Australia.
So wasn't that around the same time they introduced kudzu to Georgia? It's like another invasive species. It's like,
I don't know the history of that, but yeah, and it's all over the eastern U.S. And I think it was brought in either to stabilize erosion or as cattle food, and it just has spread all over the place.
So, yeah.
You know, but I mean, we do have a lot of great examples of species being introduced and they don't become invasive. They stay where they're supposed to be, and they're valuable economically. So it's just, we have to do a better job as a society of knowing, you know, doing the research and knowing, all right, this is a risk worth taking. It's worth, we've done the research. It shows, hey, we can introduce this as a crop plant or an ornamental plant, and it's not likely to escape where we put it. But we're still learning, and our past, you know, mistakes are something we definitely need to take into account before we make decisions like that in the future.
Oh, so it just verification. Kudzu came to the U.S. for the first time ever in 1876 for an exposition.
Wow.
But in the 1930s, the Civilian Conservation Corps introduced it for controlling soil erosion. So yeah, it did. I mean, it also controlled the ability to see pine trees or anything that got in its way. So
it produces a big blanket of green over plants that do not need that blanket.
Yes, I was here. Like speaking of monsters, my first memory of just like recurring monster images was near my home when I was a little boy, like not even five. There was a hilltop with a line of pine trees across the top that was completely coated in kudzu. So when we would go home in the evening and the sun was setting, it would look for all the world like a line of monsters in some sort of weird, happy Dr. Seussian parade. It was gorgeous, you know. Anyway.
I could definitely see that, the silhouette of those trees covered with that kudzu. They look like, yeah, these big monsters.
Yes.
You know, across the landscape.
Absolutely burned into my memory.
Wow.
And it was just like every night I would see that. It was just amazing. So, but let's get a science question in before we go. We've talked before on Monster Talk about some of the strange and interesting ways that gender changes across reptiles and amphibians. And I know that, like, we've talked about alligators and that the gender of the egg is going to be determined by the temperature that it's laid in and or that it's while it's being developed. I read that cane toads have a gender swapping thing that can happen. Are you aware of that? Or can you talk a little bit about how gender fluidity works in amphibians?
I am not familiar with that. I don't think that's well known in amphibians in general. I certainly have not. I'll have to go look that up. I do not know about that in cane toads.
A quick insert here. The article I was reading was referring to the gender-altering effects of human-made chemicals on the life cycle of amphibians. I misread the article while preparing for the show, and I thought it was talking about a previously unknown gender-swapping ability similar to some fish or the environmentally produced gender changes that some reptiles have. This is not that. But this is the same effect that led to one notable tinfoil hat-wearing philosopher to opine,
"I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay!"
And on that chunky spoonful of wisdom, we return to our interview with Dr. Stephen Johnson.
But as you mentioned, in crocodilians and turtles, you know, environmental or temperature-dependent sex determination, so they don't have the sex chromosomes like we have. And then I know in some species of fish, which is just crazy, some reef fish, you know, that I think all are male, and when the largest one disappears, you know, the biggest male becomes a female, you know, and that's just, you know, that's counter to what we think of, you know, as humans. But also, you know, we just, in our society, genders are becoming more, the way we think about that is becoming more fluid. So maybe we're becoming more like, you know, quote, animals than we think they are. But I don't know about that in cane toads or amphibians. Again, I think it's poorly studied. I'm going to have to check that out.
It is interesting. Like, even one of our earliest interviews was with biologist Steve Jones, and his specialty is slugs and snails. And he told us this thrilling story about how two slugs will come together, and they're hermaphrodites. And in a perfect world, they would both mate successfully. The male of each side would mate with the female of each side. But it's a real hassle to be the female, so one of them will try to bite off the penis of the other. So they only – it's like non-reciprocal. So
– banana slugs, I think, are that way in California.
Yeah. So it's and then there's, you know, there's fish that change gender. It's like humans have a really narrow view. Like, we know what we know, and if it's not that, we get real, that's not right. But yeah, it turns out nature's got so many more ideas about what's natural than we do. Yeah. So
there are a number of parthenogenetic reptiles.
I meant to mention that. Yeah.
A little, some geckos, lizards. There's a little snake called Ramphotyphlops braminis, the flowerpot snake, which has been it might be the most widely distributed reptile in the world because it moves around through inadvertently through movement of ornamental plants, and it's parthenogenetic, where one individual basically produces clones of itself, and so that has the advantage of if you get moved somewhere else, you only need one of you. But it has a bit of a disadvantage, is that you really cut down maybe on the amount of genetic diversity that you can produce. And the more genetic diversity, the more adaptable to change a species is. But clearly this parthenogenetic strategy has worked for a number of species. So, yeah. So the bottom line is biology is really, really interesting. It's, truth is stranger than fiction. And the more, the more we know about animals and plants and biology in general, but the more I think we realize we don't know, and we realize what an incredible world that we live in, and we need to do all we can to save this biodiversity, including these monsters, so we can learn more about them, because we might be able to apply what we learn about them to ourselves, and maybe help, come up with therapeutics or, whatever. We get insights into us as humans, the animal part of us being human. And the bottom line is we're just, we're a really highly evolved animal that's having a really major impact on the planet. And therefore we need to, it's upon us to try to do things to lessen that impact, in my opinion.
Beautifully said. Absolutely. And Blake is right. It's a hassle to be a female.
And I apologize for being a male. It's, we're just, yeah.
Well, it's certainly a hassle to be a mom. I can't speak to any of the rest of it, but I've just watched what's happened to my poor wife. And you, Karen, and everybody else who has to.
It takes its toll, but it's worth it.
Yeah. Well, as a species, we really need it. So thank you. Thank you for you and all moms everywhere.
Thank you. I should air this on Mother's Day.
Testosterone is that's the hormone that may be the downfall of the human race as we know it. So.
Yeah, indeed. Stephen, we've got a final question for you. It's a question we like to ask all of our guests.
Okay.
And that is, what's your favorite monster?
Ooh, my favorite monster. Let me think about this. Well, I have to go back to being a kid. And I was really intrigued by National Geographic, Jacques Cousteau, all this kind of stuff. And uh-huh. My favorite monster, I think, would have to be Bigfoot, but not just Bigfoot, the subspecies, quote unquote, that's in Florida, and that would be the skunk ape. That's my favorite monster. I've never seen one, but I have high hopes.
Now, so they have some sort of gland too, apparently.
They do smell, and if you want to catch one, lima beans, I've read, is a really good bait.
Interesting.
I'm not
trying to freeze them.
Mom, I can't eat these lima beans. I need to feed our Bigfoot.
That's trapping. That's why.
That's a new one. I haven't heard that.
Yeah, but it have to be Bigfoot, but specifically the skunk ape. That always intrigued me as a kid, and I'm still intrigued now. But I'm fortunate enough to get to study cane toads and other smaller monsters. So I'm a very fortunate person and scientist.
Well, I think
sure.
we're very skeptical, but I think on behalf of everyone, I really hope that the swamp apes are able to avoid the Burmese pythons and the cane toads.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Dr. Stephen Johnson of the University of Florida. I'll be putting a link to his program at UFL in the show notes, along with some photos of cane toads. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Check out our Monster Talk merchandise at monstertalk.org/store, where you can find a variety of cool products to show that you're a next-level monster enthusiast. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for listening.
Been a Monster House presentation.
And the grand prize winner,
the Hypno Toad. All glory to the Hypno Toad.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say. Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.